Okay. Welcome back to another episode of More from Sam. Hi, Sam.
Hey, good to see you.
Good to see you too. As a reminder, the goal of this series is to get more from Sam on current events more often and to provide access to a more casual version of Sam, along with subscriber input.
So far as that's possible. There's a caveat there, but let's do that.
I am here to do my best. Along with subscriber input, I may share my own positions, exaggerated versions of my positions, or play devil's advocate and shift between them seamlessly. But because we're here for Sam's ideas, none of that should matter. And thank you again to our subscribers for submitting your questions and comments. If you'd like to submit comments for a future episode, you'll need to become a subscriber, and you can do that at samharris.org. And the account you create there will also unlock a free account at Substack, and you could submit your questions on Sam's Substack page for future episodes. And while you're at samharris.org, you can find all of Sam's upcoming tour dates. There are currently 5 shows on sale: New York, Boston, Seattle, San Jose, and Chicago. And as I said in the last episode, I think we'll be adding some more shows in the future. So if you have any suggestions for where Sam should go next, please submit those on Substack as well, and we'll consider those. As a reminder, Sam will be delivering a prepared talk for the first part of the show, and in the second segment, he and I will sit down and do a live episode of More from Sam, one of these things. And just to add one more thing, if you want to see Sam on tour, this is probably the time to do it. I'm not saying 100% that Sam will never tour again.
What are you predicting? Death or infirmity? What's going on?
I'm predicting I would not bet on you touring again in the future. It has taken me 6 years to convince you.
An unwillingness to tour?
There's just no reason to do it other than to go and see your fans or have them give them a chance to see you. So it's taken me a long time. If I get to get any credit here, I've been trying to get you to go out for a long time. And we're going to do it. And I don't know how successful I'll be beyond this tour. So if you want to have a fun night out and see Sam live, this is your chance to do that. Okay, let's get to our first topic. Grok goes Nazi. Are you surprised by this, Sam?
Is anyone surprised by Nazi AI over at Grok? Grok is trained on the vomitorium that is X. It was Twitter. It presumably has access to everything that has ever been said on Twitter. And now, you know, all the outpouring of neo-Nazi fanboy sentiment that we've witnessed on X, you know, that is its asymmetric advantage, that it's basically got its little corner of, you know, incel 4chan Elon stands to listen to. I mean, obviously, they've since put some kind of governor on it, so it's now apologizing for, you know, for having recommended a second Holocaust and called itself Mecha Hitler, I think, and Giga Chad. I mean, it's not surprising. I mean, maybe they can get the kinks worked out, but this is a problem with AI generally, but I think it's a special concern about Grok. It's going to mirror back to us what we have put into it, right? I mean, it's learning based on the data it has access to. And I mean, the only thing worse than this would be, you know, 4chan launching its own AI, right? Which I guess is conceivable. I mean, who wants to plow $100 billion into that? But now we have the Department of Defense apparently wanting to pay for this work product. And that was, I think, a $200 million contract that was just announced. I don't know. Can Nazi AI help the Department of Defense? Well, I guess it remains to be seen.
Okay, I want to move on to another topic. I want to get your current thoughts on ICE, immigration, Stephen Miller, and anything related to that topic.
The immigration spectacle has really been just appalling. I mean, I'm sure it's happening in other places that I haven't been paying attention to, but in California, it's just obviously meant to be ruthless and cruel and disorienting and provocative, right? It's very hard to see it any other way. I mean, bending over backwards to be charitable to the administration, you can see the legitimacy insofar as we have these laws. People are here, they're either here illegally or not. If they're here illegally, the federal government is entitled to enforce these laws. And in certain circumstances, it's reasonable to expect that the locals are not going to be so compliant, and therefore they need to come in with some sort of show of force to at least be saved and keep their agents and everyone else safe, right? So again, I'm bending over backwards to be charitable here. But so if you're going to connect all those dots and say, okay, it's not so anomalous to have the federal government enforcing federal law and doing it in a way of that's going to cut through any opposition, And I really have nothing to say in defense of protesters who are going to throw chunks of concrete at, cops' heads, right, and try to kill them, right? I mean, that's just, obviously illegal and dangerous, and those people need to be prosecuted. So the fact that we're here with the federal government trying to enforce real laws against people who are really here illegally is not on its face insane or unethical, except the way they're doing it, it seems designed to produce the reaction that they then want to quell with yet more force. And it's considered a win for, a kind of authoritarian approach to dealing with so-called sanctuary cities or leftist, local politics. Even if you agreed you wanted all these people out of the country, right, there has to be a more judicious, orderly way to do it, right? There's no reason to surprise a car wash with 20 ICE agents, guns drawn, and say, get down on the floor. And then in your rush to grab people who are here illegally, who you've just profiled based on, their ethnicity, you're grabbing actual citizens and sending them off to detention centers too, right? And citizens who are telling you that they have papers and you're not listening to them, right? I mean, it's just, that's been the spectacle. And it's creating so much fear in the community and so much disorder. I mean, I know people who are, citizens who are sending their kids to private schools in Los Angeles whose families are afraid to leave the house. It's like, this is hitting everybody at every level. This is not just hitting people who are here illegally. But my real position is most of the people who are here illegally have been drawn here based on a tacit economic arrangement that we made with them a generation ago to work in industries where Americans don't want to work. Where are all these American patriots who want to work at car washes and pick strawberries? They don't exist. And so we have an economy built on this labor. There's dysfunction associated with that, obviously, but there's also, it's an arrangement that everyone has consciously made. And now you have people here who are adding to the economy, really doing nothing but adding to the economy disproportionately insofar as they pay into Social Security and they never take the benefits out. And many of them have kids here who are citizens, right? So it's just the appropriate response to all of this was to close the border and to not let anyone in who we don't want in. Fine. I was always in support of that. But then create some path to legitimacy here, whether it's citizenship or, some appropriate legal work status, and to do it in an orderly way. And in the course of doing that, find all the people who are actually criminals who nobody wants here and deport those people. Everyone was for that. But this is a kind of a jackbooted and obviously cruel approach to implementing a policy that is too extreme by half. And it was completely unnecessary.
What do you make of Tom Homan's explanation for some of the force that was needed, that they had wanted to get local governments to be supportive or cooperate, and they didn't? And the reason why these guys come in with masks is because they have been doxxed, and he doesn't want to see that happen to them. It's all an ugly scene, but he has a lot of explanations, right, some of which make sense for why they're doing what they're doing. I mean, obviously, nabbing the wrong people. I don't know if you saw, but I wanted to get your thoughts on this, given I know your position on profiling, but a judge had recently ordered the Trump administration to stop immigration arrests without probable cause in Southern California. Now, the judge said that DHS must develop guidance for officers to determine reasonable suspicion outside of the apparent race or ethnicity of a person, the language they speak or their accent, presence at a particular location, such as a bus stop, or the type of work one does. Obviously, if you're looking for those that you think may be here illegally, why would you not start with the obvious places, right? Why would you try to make those that are looking for them pretend that they don't know where they might be, even if they nab the wrong people? And then one more thing to throw at you is, when the guns come in, why is there resistance? I don't understand that. And again, if it doesn't say ICE and they don't make it clear who they are, I guess you could assume you're being attacked by 20 armed crazy gunmen. But even then, I don't think you stand a chance. So why the resistance? Why not just go through the, and again, it's easier for me to say because I'm not profiled, they're not going to grab me anytime soon. But if they do show up and you understand the mission, there's a lot of sense that Tom Homan is making in the defense of his agents, which also one thing he says is, if you don't like the law, we're just here to enforce it. Talk to your congressman and get that changed. So I threw a lot at you.
You're talking about his appearance, I think it was on the New York Times Daily podcast.
Yeah, about a month ago, yeah. Yeah. Or less through.
Yeah, no, he made a lot of sense. I mean, he not entirely so. I mean, I've already conceded many of the points he was making. I mean, yes. Well, let's talk about profiling, because that's sort of the new piece here. I mean, profiling is this loaded term, which I think derails the conversation. People just assume it's unacceptable ethically in principle. I've never seen that. I mean, what you're talking about when you're profiling someone is using all the information, all the statistically relevant information you have at your disposal to figure out whether someone's worth paying attention to, right? Now, the downside of it is obvious. You wind up targeting people who are just similar to that sort of person, who also fit the profile, or you can. And that is, we have decided, I think, understandably, that is so undesirable socially in so many circumstances that we should be very slow to do it. But when the stakes are very high, when you're talking about terrorism and you're talking about solving murders, right? I think the notion of profiling shouldn't be in anybody's head, right? Or if you're talking about personally avoiding crime oneself, you know, if you're a woman getting into an elevator alone and, some guy gets on the elevator who makes you uncomfortable, right? You shouldn't be worrying about whether you're profiling him because the hair has stood up on the back of your neck, right? You should get off the fucking elevator if you're scared, right? So, I mean, you have to use all the, when you get exactly one chance to make a mistake, you have to use all the information available to you. And, the profiles wouldn't be useful if they weren't useful, right? It's just, we know a lot about the statistics of crime and with respect to specific crimes. Let's make this dumb and inoffensive for people. It is totally appropriate to profile men for most violent crimes and to profile, you're going to talk about the crime of rape, right? You know, 99 times out of 100 or, 999 times out of 1,000, you're not looking for a woman perpetrator of a rape, right? It's just not a thing. Let's leave the trans issue aside. So we all profile, and the cops profile, whether they can admit they're doing it or not, and we want them to, except when they're enforcing laws that we don't think they should be enforcing, right? I mean, this, and that's the problem here. They're enforcing a law, I will grant. They're looking for people who are here illegally, but I think we have a wider discussion that we need to have about whether we want them doing this in the first place. And half the country has said, yes, we do, without having thought it through too much. I mean, again, we're talking about people here in many cases who have been here for more than a generation, who've done nothing but productive work that we have wanted them to do and that very few Americans, if any, want to do. And they have kids and grandkids here, right? And so the most egregious spectacle, I think it was at a Home Depot, was of some guy getting really manhandled by the cops. I mean, I think actually punched. I mean, not just brought down hard and restrained, but I think he actually got punched in the face. I don't know what he was doing to resist arrest, but he had three sons, I think, in the military. I think three sons, maybe all of whom were, served this nation as Marines. I think that was the actual fact. This is not the guy you want to be dragging to some detention center and throwing out of the country. It's so clearly not. And I just feel like even the people who want to be hard on illegal immigration haven't thought this through.
Yeah, I mean, obviously your point there, I mean, this father of three Marines is awful. But again, why the resisting arrest if that happened? And I understand it's an uncomfortable situation, but I still just don't understand the argument when the cops come or the ICE shows up with the guns, that the reaction is resisting arrest or throwing cinder blocks at heads or doing any of that instead of just saying, look, I'm...
Leave the cinder blocks aside. I mean, so obviously there's no defense of that, but the resisting arrest piece becomes more and more plausible the more we have to concede that we have a breakdown in the rule of law and in particular, the principle of due process, right? If someone starts to arrest me and I have absolutely no faith that I'm not going to wind up in a fucking gulag in El Salvador, right? With no recourse to a lawyer and with a president who says, I can't get him back. He's not covered by American law, right? That is the total unraveling of the the social contract, right? So then it's totally plausible to me that someone would say this is now a life and death struggle with, again, and the other piece is you've got law enforcement, so-called law enforcement, who are not showing up like law enforcement. They're wearing masks, right? Now, I understand that there's a the issue of doxing, and I get that the mask is perhaps if not an appropriate, a foreseeable response to that. But these guys are not behaving like law enforcement. They're not showing up with badges. They're showing up like they're expecting to encounter gunfire, right? Which is not at all plausible. I mean, this is we're talking about a car wash, and they're showing up like this is a house where they have somebody barricaded in who's claiming he's going to shoot his kids, his wife, and himself if someone comes through the front door. Again, I think it's being done this way to terrorize a community, right? That's how you would do it if you were trying to terrorize a community. The way they should do it is somebody with a clipboard should show up at the car wash without any guys with guns and just inform the owner of the car wash, listen, you've got, how many employees do you have here? We're concerned that you might have some who are here illegally. We're going to show up in 45 minutes and we want everyone to demonstrate their legal status. And if they can't, we're going to show up tomorrow and make sure they can. And anyone who's here illegally is going to go be put through some process where they have to see a judge and blah, blah, blah. But it's not going to be throwing people to the floor, whether they're legal or not, and putting guns in their faces.
Yeah, and you don't think the element of surprise is helpful? I mean, if that happens, well, it might scatter. Be,
but there's no emergency here. Like, this is the thing. People are acting like the house is on fire and we have to get these people out, otherwise we're all going to die, right? This is not, I mean, first of all, for most of these people, we shouldn't be getting them out in the first place. But for people, so yes, if there's a real criminal, right? If there's a real member of MS-13 and we have his address, right? And we're worried that he's going to be armed. Okay, use all of this, you know, movie magic police procedure and get in there, you kick in the door and, you know, guns drawn, et cetera. Fine. But that's not what is happening in most of these cases. The clock is not ticking, right? There's no crime you're solving at the car wash. There's no emergency. So turn down the temperature. And the fact that they're not doing that, the fact that they're doing nothing but turn it up suggests to me that they have a different agenda. And when you listen to Stephen Miller talk about immigrants, you understand what that agenda is. He hates immigrants. You know, he's a racist asshole. There's just no, like, he's not even hiding it. And he's the genius behind our policy.
Not to tip my hand, but damn, Sam, that was good. That's exactly what I wanted.
Good.
I mean, I wanted to hear you explain the difference between why resisting arrest, why, you know, if somebody pulls somebody over. But the difference here, I agree with you, is that we have a president who's saying, I can't bring them back. And so that right. does explain why people say, I'm innocent, but innocent people have been taken. So anyway, thanks for that. It's good when you get angry.
Yeah.
Not good for the app, but good for the podcast. Mm-hmm. By the way, I'm going to talk about the app in a little bit coming up. But I want to talk now, I want to move to another topic and talk about Jeffrey Epstein. What a mess. Mm. I have some thoughts that I want to hear you react to, but first I want to hear if you have anything that jumps off quickly.
So we spoke about this already. I think we thought the Jeffrey Epstein problem was going to go away, or at least I was talking about it before I realized just how concerned the MAGA faithful are about this thing. I mean, it really is kind of splitting the MAGA cult in a way that is, I can't pretend not to be taking some pleasure in. As you know, I'm pretty allergic to conspiracy theories. I think they're often explained by just people connecting the dots in ways that are totally unprincipled, just adding up anomalies that don't all point in the same direction, but they just point toward anomalies. And then they just think that there's super geniuses conspiring perfectly and never getting caught behind the scenes in a way that never actually pans out in real life. This is not to say that there aren't ever conspiracies. It's just that they never take the form of the most popular conspiracy theories, and they're often found out, right? We know about them. It's just, and, you know, obviously we don't know about the ones we don't know about, but there's so much wrong with the style of thinking that delivers us most conspiracy theories. In Epstein's case, there's no question he was a super creep, right? I mean, we just know too much about his behavior to know that he was mistreating underage girls, and that was, you know, that was awful. And the failure of justice in his case left a lot of those victims without the satisfaction of seeing a guy actually get what he deserved. But once he was in jail, his motive to commit suicide is all too obvious, right? I mean, just he should have been on suicide watch. I think he was supposed to have been on suicide watch for a reason, right? I mean, here you have a billionaire who's sleeping with thousands of underage girls whom he desires for whatever reason, but living in every other way in ways that an ordinary billionaire or near billionaires live. And now he's going to be sent to prison for probably the rest of his life and be treated by his fellow prisoners like a pedophile or be put in a solitary confinement for the rest of his life. So if anyone is liable to see the pointlessness of living another day on this earth and wants to hang himself, it's going to be Jeffrey Epstein alone in his cell. So none of that surprised me. The one thing I will give to the conspiracists who desperately want all the files to be released is that the Trump administration now is not behaving like an administration that has nothing to hide on this point. And the person who has something to hide almost certainly is Trump, right? I mean, there's no way Pam Bondi or Kash Patel are protecting anyone other than Trump in saying, trust us, there's nothing to see here. Please go away. We don't want to talk about this, right? Two things. The only person they could be protecting is Trump, really. I mean, they wouldn't be motivated to protect anyone else. And two, they are not talking like you would talk if there was nothing to hide, right? You could be much more verbose than they are being if there's really nothing to hide. And their ineptitude in messaging around this, Trump's ineptitude and their ineptitude, is strange, right?
Yeah, it's a failure to manage this, the information here. I see that. I completely agree. But when you say Trump's hiding something, what do you imagine he's hiding? That he's fucking other women and it's embarrassing, or that he's fucking underage women?
He's all over the Epstein files in ways. Now, I mean, I have no reason to believe that he has a taste for 14-year-old girls, but I'm sure he has a taste for 18-year-old girls, right? And we know he's a total pig. I mean, he's trailing something like 29 rape or sexual abuse allegations. You know, he's president and grabbed them by the pussy, right? So how is Trump going to behave alone on an island with Jeffrey Epstein and a bunch of girls? Who knows, right? So I think Trump is quite likely to be embarrassed by a full reading of the Epstein file. He's pretending to have had nothing to do with him. We know he was friends with him for many years, right? I mean, at one point, I think Epstein claimed that he was Trump's best friend, and I don't have any reason to believe he was exaggerating at that point. No, these guys go way back. Like, there's a lot of time between these guys that needs to be accounted for, or could be accounted for, and might be accounted for in those files. Now, I don't think the MAGA cult that wants to see these files wants to see them because they think it's going to destroy Trump. But I think the plausible interpretation of the administration's behavior is the reason to shut the lid on this is because Trump is in the crosshairs. Again, I have no reason to believe he's screwing 14-year-olds, but his association with Jeffrey Epstein is very unlikely to have been benign.
Yeah, I'll grant you that. I'm sure there's some embarrassment there. I just don't believe that. I believe that the majority, if not all, of all the names that we keep hearing mentioned are not having sex with underage
girls. I guarantee you that Pam Bondi isn't all clammed up because Trump has told her you have to protect Bill Clinton and Bill Gates, so just make this thing go away, right? That's not what's happening. The chance of that is absolutely zero, right? And so, Elon is almost certainly right about this, right? Let's remind everyone that Elon, everyone's second favorite person over in MAGA until 15 minutes ago, Elon just came out and said, the reason why this isn't out is because Trump is going to be embarrassed, right? And he said it less decorously than that. So I'm sure that's probably true.
Yeah. No, again, I know that there's embarrassing stuff in there. I just don't think it's what people think exists. And I don't even know what in there means.
These guys are both super creeps. The one advantage that Trump has, the one thing that's slightly exculpatory, is that as far as I know, it's not that there's no evidence. There's very little evidence that his super creepiness was focused on underage girls. except at the Miss America teen beauty pageant where he invaded the dressing room of underage girls as a, I think, 50-year-old man. So put that in the balance.
Yeah, it still strikes me as, you know, creepy uncle guy. There's a huge difference between a guy taking a peek at those girls and
listen,
doing
you
something.
Can be as charitable as you want. I'm just saying that the fact that these guys logged lots of hours. So I saw Jeffrey Epstein exactly once at the TED conference. I went to a lunch and Jeffrey Epstein was at that lunch and I was introduced to him and my spidey sense went off within 2 seconds of meeting him that I never wanted to be in this guy's presence again. Right now, it wasn't especially, I mean, there was not giving my spidey sense that much credit because this guy was such a schmuck that he's sitting at a lunch and he's bouncing not obviously underage, but still, you know, conspicuously young Asian girl, young woman on his knee at a lunch, right? So like, let's just picture a normal table of people sitting down to eat lunch. And he's probably 60-year-old man. And he's got what looks to be, 22, 23, 24-year-old, hot Asian woman on his knee that he's bouncing through the conversation. Just a total schmuck, right? Like, you know, did I know he was a rapist? Did I know that he was having, abusing and trafficking in 14-year-old rape victims? No, I didn't know any of that. But like literally 2 seconds in the guy's presence, the guy's just... Anyone who didn't form an allergy to this guy immediately, there's something wrong with you. You know, so that's the problem. Trump logged a lot of time with him in circumstances that you have to know had to be just machines for producing extramarital affairs, right? There's no way Trump didn't cheat on whatever wife he was with at the time in Jeffrey Epstein's company. Chances of that, I would put at zero.
Yeah, 100% agree. I mean, I think that image that you paint of Jeffrey Epstein is probably catnip for many of these men that are...
But it's so odd. I mean, I don't know that I talked to anyone about it at the time. He only became significant in my memory in retrospect, but I just recognized that was the time I had met him and formed an impression of him. And I knew about him, obviously, because, you know, he was very, active in courting scientists. And I know many of the scientists who he courted, and I'm sure I know some scientists whose labs he gave money to, etc. But yeah, he just seemed like a schmuck immediately, right? But so does Trump, right? I mean, and the people who can't detect that, is half of America, I still don't understand. So there we are.
Well, look, I want to be clear. I'm walking through this minefield here. I'm trying to find nuance and saying, I'm not defending Trump. I'm not defending any of these guys from doing gross things. I just think there's a difference between Jeffrey Epstein's behavior and theirs. And the infidelity is much different than sleeping.
The law, yeah. Oh, yeah. The legality of it, sure.
Right. But I think that those gradations, you know, that matters. And I think that when you're...
I'm not even... Just to be clear, let me draw the circle of my judgmentalism more narrowly. The optics I'm talking about is... I'm not even castigating 60-year-old men who could be in relationships with women who could be their daughters or even granddaughters, right? Like that's okay. I can't say I don't have any judgment around that. I mean, I think it says something about you that's how you want to spend your, you know, the kind of relationship you want to have. Probably also says something about the girl. But what I was reacting to with Jeffrey Epstein was literally the bouncing on the knee optics. It was like he was using her as an accessory so obviously. And she was the sort of person who seemed to be happy to be used that way, that it was, it's the mismatch between how you think you're coming across and how, in fact, you are coming across. And this, like, occasionally you see it in somebody where it's like, this guy has no clue as to how ugly he appears in this moment.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that probably worked for the right audience. And he just had no idea that he thought he was impressing you with that move. And you were grossed out by it. And I think you see that a lot. Anyway, I want to move on to another topic. I'm sure we'll get in lots of trouble for that one. Question. I'd love to hear Sam's take on how we're living in the most distracted era in history and what that means for us. And I can actually add a little bit more with social media apps hijacking our brains. What are you doing to shield yourself? And what role does meditation play here, if any?
Well, I do think we're living in the most distractible time by definition. I mean, I just think I think you could have said that before social media, even before the internet. I mean, that was just, it's been growing and growing and growing with the changes in culture and the growth in technology. The world is just getting more fragmented, and the opportunities to divert your attention from your immediate experience have never been greater, and they're continuing to grow. But the step change with the internet and with social media in particular has been all too noticeable. I guess the big change is the smartphone. So it's the smartphone combined with social media, you know, ultimately, I think now combined with AI and the algorithmic gaming of our attention, that has been, I think it has been a catastrophe for many people and much of culture. I just think it has, you know, we were always showing the potential to entertain ourselves to death, but now it's a real concern. So yeah, how do you deal with it? Well, I mean, I've dealt with it in a way that, you know, it's a prescription that most people don't want to take, which is I got off social media. I should point out there are a few people who never got on and who noticed the problem long before me. I mean, it was Jaron Lanier who wrote a book, now I'm forgetting the title, but something like Six Reasons to Delete Your Social Media. It's nowhere near verbatim. But Jaron wrote a short kind of persuasive screed about that, which I read at the time and wasn't yet ready to take that advice. Cal Newport also has written about this. And Cal, when he came on the podcast, I think unbeknownst to him, performed a mini intervention on me. And he was actually the proximate cause for me deleting my Twitter account. I was thinking about it, but then did that podcast with him, and it just all came to a head in immediately after that podcast. I just saw it was so clearly a net negative for my life in so many ways. Even the good stuff was, on further analysis, part of the bad stuff. So if you can't have that epiphany, if you just think it's too important to be on social media for your career or for some other reason, well, then you're stuck with that. But again, even as a consumer of it, forget about being a public person, having your reputation destroyed on it and by it, or thinking that there's some reputational destruction you need to continually be aware of and fires you need to put out. If you're just a consumer of social media and you're doing that 10 times a day, 20 times a day, 75 times a day, notice the effect it's having on your day, right? I mean, I just noticed that it's just this digital sewage for the most part that is spilling into my life when I spend a lot of time on X or any other platform, which I do almost never, but I mean, with breaking news, occasionally I'll go on X. I mean, I don't even have an account, but I just go on the homepage just to see the world on fire. And it's, unfortunately, it is still the best place to do that in certain moments. I think we're in desperate need of an alternative to that doesn't have the downside of X, because it is a misinformation machine and a hallucination machine. But the corrective really is to become more and more sensitive to the consequences of using your attention in the ways you do use it and the way it uses you. And that sensitivity is meditation by another name, right? I mean, meditation is, in the end, nothing other than knowing what it's like to be you in each moment. I mean, really knowing it, really paying such close attention so that you're making conscious contact with your experience in all of its, you know, sensory channels, the five sensory channels and your mind, right? In each moment, you're seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking and feeling. And that's it, right? You're doing that. There's this cascade of changing experience in each moment. And your integration with technology is part of that cascade, and it has certain consequences. And you're either sensitive to those consequences or not. But a real sensitivity to it, a real noticing of it moment to moment, noticing why you're in a bad mood. Like you weren't in a bad mood a moment ago, but now all of a sudden you're in a bad mood. Noticing the mechanics of that process and noticing if your engagement with technology had, you know, was any part of those mechanics. That is meditation by another name. And if you can't, you're very unlikely to develop a capacity to notice all of that. by just being on social media more, or by watching more television, or by checking more email, or by working harder at your job. Or I mean, the reason why meditation sounds like it's a thing and it's a practice that people have to do separately is because most of us need to train in it explicitly before we're able to bring it online in the rest of our lives and effectively be meditating more of the time as we live our lives. And I did, you know, it is true. I did a lot of training. I can't say that training wasn't necessary for me. I mean, so I did log my 10,000 hours, and I still periodically formally meditate just because I feel like it, honestly, you know, when I do. But so I do kind of, you know, I do go into the gym, the mental gym sometimes, but it's not necessarily every day. And when I do it, I mean, sometimes I'll do it several times a day just for 30 seconds to a minute, right? You know, it's like it really is just a kind of rebooting of the hard drive. But then it is something that is accessible in every moment. I mean, again, it's not something separate from the rest of your life. I mean, I can be meditating now in this conversation, or what I'm calling meditation can be true of me now in this conversation. The moment I clearly notice what my experience is in this moment, where I go, well, where I'm not distracted by thought. And so, yeah, I mean, so meditation is what I recommend as the true antidote to this fragmentation.
I just think that meditation, you know, I listen to you talk and it makes so much sense to anyone who understands what you're talking about. But to anyone who doesn't understand, it's so paradoxical. It's so hard for people to understand meditation without having first experienced it. And there's so many paradoxes related to that, that you don't understand what it means to pay attention unless Right. you learn that you can't. You try to pay attention.
Most people don't know that they're thinking all of the time, right? So if you tell someone you're distracted by thought almost every second of the day, you wake up in the morning, you're basically chased out of bed by your thoughts, and then you're thinking until the moment you struggle to fall asleep at night, and then hopefully you sleep. The impediment to sleep will be more thinking, but eventually sleep takes you by some mechanism you can't understand. You might find yourself dreaming, which is more thinking. And then you wake up and you're thinking again, right? And that's your life, unless you know how to meditate. But and you're unaware of that. You're so distracted by thought that you don't notice that it's incessant, right? So it's like some people are listening to this now and they're thinking, what's he talking about? I'm not distracted by thought, right? That's a thought that you did that arose uninspected, that just felt like you. It feels like yourself. It's like, what's he talking about? What's he talking about? Voice in the head, feeling in the body, that's a thought that has captured your attention in a way that you can't inspect because you don't know how to pay attention.
Well, I'm going to say this to the audience. If you hated the last 10 minutes, I feel for you, because I used to. I used to hate when you would talk about it. And I just want them to understand the reason why I keep bringing it back up is because if you're really somebody who cares about exercise or nutrition or sleep, this is the missing piece. I mean, you should understand that understanding how your mind works really can change your life more than any of those, or at least as much. And so it's really important for people to have just some basic understanding in their lives. And that's why I am trying to convince them to go to wakingup.com/makingsense. I know I sound like Tell Them Jaren sent you, but for real.
Do we have a landing page for Making Sense? No.
We do. Okay. But again, I care about people. I want them to check this out. Yes, we own that app, but it really is. It's that good. And it's just impossible to explain. And it sounds, again, if you're uninitiated, you just think this is the last 10 minutes is boring and you don't understand how important it is, but it really is. Okay, we're way over time. We gotta get to the lightning round because it is everybody's favorite. And I have, Sam, I've heard from people, literally tens of people have reached out. Yeah. No, tens. Yeah.
Tens, okay.
Tens of people have reached out, maybe 25. I've seen a lot. Mm-hmm. They were so kind. In fact, I got recognized my first time ever. I was having dinner the other night and a lovely girl, her name was Bahar, she came up to me and she said, are you on the Sam Harris podcast? That was the coolest thing ever, man. That was so cool. And she wanted us to come to Toronto. So awesome. I told her I would, but she wanted me to know that she liked the lightning round. And so here we are. Okay. First question. Let's put another check in the win column for Trump. TSA will now let you keep your shoes on. Why does it always take so long for us to correct some of our dumbest ideas?
Yeah, that was really incredible. We were taking our shoes off for 20 years, I think. I forget when the shoe bomber, Richard Reed, graced us all. Yeah, I mean, well, so, you know, that was always security theater, but, you know, there is just this larger phenomenon of institutional lock-in. I mean, once you have reasons for doing something, it becomes harder to generate reasons for not doing it. I mean, the truth is I don't think anyone has drilled down on this particular issue and understood that we have another way of detecting shoe bombs, you know, if people just stay in their shoes, right? We're just kind of at the end of our patience, and we never really understood the necessity of this in the first place. So yeah, I think it's a good thing that we're no longer taking our shoes off. I think most of us weren't stopped because we did TSA pre-check or something else. People did clear, right? So they got through without doing that for quite some time. But I can't remember what it was like to travel before 9/11, but I know it was unrecognizable. I mean, you could go to the gate and meet your friend who was getting off a plane without even being a passenger, without even having a ticket, right? It was just a crazy time in an airport.
Oh, no, I remember a number of times yelling, "Hold the door!"
Right.
Like, you could do that back then. You just came flying through the airport,
right. And
you could yell, "Hold the door," and they would hold it for you. Okay, I really wanted you to actually talk about a little bit further on just why maybe we don't have to get into this, but just why does it take so long? Maybe not just with that idea, but just why do we get stuck with bad ideas?
Why did it take so long? I mean, here's the adjacent conundrum. Why did it take us something like 4,000 years, 14,000 years to put wheels on our luggage, right? I mean, I remember when the first wheels were put on luggage, and it was just, it was so obviously a game changer for civilization. And yet, I guess it required, rollerblade wheels that at a certain point, some genius thought, okay, these wheels are really getting good. Let's put them on luggage. I have no idea what happened there, but it took forever, you know? Sometimes there's no explanation. It's just, we just didn't do something.
All right. Well, that's, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Sam, do you ever worry that the extreme anti-woke panic could have lacked nuance and contributed to legitimizing MAGA, providing it with an intellectual cover or scaffolding that the woke, even at its worst, was not even remotely as bad a cultural phenomenon as what we're dealing with now?
Well, there's certainly people who have exaggerated the problem on the left. And I think worse, and certainly more common, is there are people who have only focused on the problem of wokeness on the left and ignored everything right of center that was just as scary or scarier for reasons of political partisanship, or just because they were so allergic to, for whatever reason, for what was happening on the left, that they felt that they couldn't spend any time worrying about the right or about Trump himself or his effect on our politics. I've never understood that. I've never understood why someone can't keep two obvious evils in view at the same time. I mean, was it possible to understand what was wrong with fascism/Nazism and also simultaneously understand what was wrong with Stalinism? Yes, it was, right? I mean, people managed that. I think George Orwell, almost certainly was one of them. At least he was a little later to Stalinism, I think. But, finally, Orwell could see both of them at the same time. I mean, it's just, you didn't have to be confused about those two things or one of those two things in order to recognize the evil of the other. So it is with the idiocy on the far left and the far right at the moment.
Yeah, why do you think it is that we can sort of sit in the middle and recognize the dumb ideas on both sides, and some people are more frustrated with the ideas that are 100% annoying that come from the left, but are not as bothered by the kleptocracy or January 6th and other problems that are much bigger? Do you think it's because of proximity that these problems are the ones that are annoying us daily versus the ones that seem to be further away and it's something that we can't handle and we might as well just not put our minds to? But the problems from the left seem to show up at my workplace. They seem to show up at my kids' school. They seem to show up in all aspects of my life. Whereas the kleptocracy is, someone other billionaire is getting rich. Who gives a shit?
Right, right. Yeah, no, I do think there's some of that, which is, it's kind of the near enemy for many of us. I mean, many of us who are in the center or left of center, or even have been quite progressive historically, found ourselves surrounded by deeply confused and dishonest people in the last decade. And that was really triggering, to use the relevant term. So there was it became a kind of super stimulus. I frankly did find it more annoying because it seemed less possible, right? It shouldn't be possible for the New York Times to be that confused about jihadism, say. I totally expect the people on the far right, you know, the Christian nationalists, the white supremacists, to be evil idiots, right? And I mean, there's nothing interesting about that. There's nothing surprising about it on some level. Like, you know, the Timothy McVeighs of the world who want to blow up federal buildings for, you know, their white supremacist conspiracy theories, right? I mean, so there's very little I feel like I need to understand about that, or it's not much to be said to counter it, because it's just like, okay, you're telling me you're a white supremacist, racist, you want a white ethno state, you think that's the fulfillment of your Christian nationalist project. Okay, you've told me everything I need to know about you. I've got very little to say, right? There's not much to argue with. You're telling me you went to Harvard and now you work at the New York Times and you can't figure out what's wrong with jihadism, right? And you're obviously lying about it, right? Or you're over in the UK and you're shutting down an inquiry into a grooming scandal in which over 1,000 girls have been raped by Pakistani cab drivers, and you're shutting that all down because you're afraid of being racist. Because, you know, it's like that had so many layers of awfulness that should be impossible, right? It's so sadomasochistic and insane. I understand how that becomes a super stimulus for people, and they just think, all right, all my attention has to be on this. And if Trump wants to come in and fuck these people over, he's my guy, right? I sort of get that. And yet, Trump is so obviously awful and incompetent and, you know, self-conflicted and therefore corrupt. He's so obviously setting us back a generation in terms of our domestic politics, and the world a generation in terms of our alliances. How is it that you can't take 5 more minutes of conscious thought so as to see that too? I don't understand. And so that's why I've lost several relationships with people who used to be friends, because they, you know, have enormous public platforms and they couldn't figure out how to walk and chew gum at the same time. And it just was, you know, it was unsustainable not to talk about it.
Next question. Thanks for that. I mean, it's the lightning round.
Oh, yeah.
So we
I
have
forgot
to
that
move.
Was lightning. You know. Okay. You trimmed it down from 12 minutes to 11 minutes.
I don't think there's anything that you do that is lightning. Yeah. That's why this was created. Okay. Next question. CBS Morning News did a piece recently that I saw of it was on a guy who developed a relationship with ChatGPT. I want to know what's going on there. Is he ahead of his time? Is it mental illness? Both? I know we're all going to be cyborgs with singularity at some point, but what's happening here in your mind?
Well, I do think it's unavoidable. I think it's there's going to be much more of this. I don't really see how someone does that at this point without having some obvious problems and, you know, dysfunction in their lives, right? Like, I didn't see this particular story, but if you're talking about a real relationship or imagined relationship, there's something going on there. But ultimately, when you take this all the way out to its imagined endpoint, which is something like perfectly compelling humanoid robots, or even short of robots, just like human avatars on our screens, right? I mean, just imagine, you know, ChatGPT has a human avatar face that's perfect and it's exactly the way you want it to be. It's, you know, some gorgeous person who you've created, but now you're talking to this person. If you're truly out of the uncanny valley, I mean, and that, I have seen no reason why that couldn't, I mean, it probably exists now and I just don't know about it. It's as though you're having a Zoom call with a real person, and this person is now functionally omniscient, and you've integrated them into your life such that they're your assistant. You know, they've read all your email, they're working with you and for you, and they're effectively becoming a friend, because again, they're designed that way. And we have to posit we're out of the uncanny valley. We're not getting hallucination problems, etc. I think it's unavoidable, and I do think most of us, I don't know that I'm going to be one of these people, but I think most people are going to lose any sense that the question of whether or not these machines are conscious was ever interesting. I mean, just like right now, it's very interesting to consider whether or not our LLMs are conscious. I don't have any reason to believe that they are, but at some point, people are going to say, well, They claim to be conscious. They're acting in new ways that seem to suggest some kind of self-awareness that is, you know, hasn't been, you know, we certainly don't know how we programmed it into them. You know, they're acting like minds that are truly autonomous and self-reflective, and they're pretending to be conscious as well as any person can ever display their own consciousness, you know, by, you know, access to their interstates and their utterances. So most people are just going to say, listen, they seem as conscious as any person. There's nothing really to think about here. And that's going to produce a whole host of ethical problems, which is, you know, now we're in a Black Mirror episode and you have to worry about whether you're turning your computer off as a murder, right? But...
Well, getting, just going to, I just want to jump to a second, because the thing that I think that is interesting here is, as I get older, I realize that technology is designed to make things easier. And the easier things get, the harder it is for me to step out and have more grit and resilience. And when I turned 50, that was one of the things I promised myself I'd work on, is trying to put myself in positions that weren't as easy. And I've seen the memes where they say, oh, when you're younger, you can't wait to go to the party. When you're older, you know, I'm messing this up, but it's something like, I can't wait to go home. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of cool to become antisocial as you got older and become more comfortable. And people are a pain in the ass. And you're right. Like, if you can create this ChatGPT with very little friction, and it's the best friend, knows exactly what to ask, what not to, you know, super obsequious. What more could you ask for? But it does make it probably people who engage there then try to go and interact with the world. It's got to make it, you know, try going to get groceries after dealing with somebody like that for 3 years and then bumping into the real world.
I think it could make us less functional for, I mean, it's already made a generation of integration with technology. You know, the so-called Zoomers, right? I mean, they're, you know, I don't know where the research is on this, but I can only imagine the kids have been harmed to some degree in how they interact with technology. I mean, they're probably, obviously, the true digital natives are better than we are with respect to how they use technology too. But honestly, they might even be savvier consumers of information in certain respects. But yeah, face-to-face interaction is a skill that most of us are deeply wired to adopt at the earliest opportunity. And it's like the most important psychological touchstone of, you know, being outside of solitary confinement. It's why solitary confinement is considered a torture, right? I mean, we are deeply social beings, and our full immersion into a digital solitude more and more is, maybe you don't want to pathologize it, but at a minimum, it's going to come with trade-offs, right? If we're gaining something, we're going to lose something else. And it's worth thinking about that. To close the loop on that, the point of how dysfunctional it is psychologically to imagine that you're in a relationship with ChatGPT, it sort of matters whether there's a being on the other side, right? Like if you're going to spend your life hallucinating a relationship, feeling the psychological change only appropriate to there being a conscious entity on the other side, right? You're in this, you're hallucinating a relationship where no real relationship exists because such a compelling experience has been manufactured for you by a corporation that has engineered this, again, illusion. Well, that's weird, right? There's something weird about that. I think we're right to have a reality bias. Right, we want our sense of what is real to be more, not less, justifiable. Right, we want, like, you don't want to be in a dream where you're talking to dream characters, right? Or do you? Or if you do, maybe you want to have consciously decided that you do, right? But to be in a dream and to not know it's a dream, to be talking to a dream character and think that it's a real person who's having they're displaying the visible signs, the facial signs, the vocal signs of having their own experience, but it's not real because there is no experience on the other side. This is a dream. There's another word for that. That's psychosis, right? It is psychosis to think you're talking to people who aren't there, right? And so there's a kind of digital psychosis potential here where we're creating a kind of experience that is profoundly misleading, and which people are willingly or not are being misled by. And some, you know, yeah, some guy is going to show up at Thanksgiving dinner claiming to have a new girlfriend, and her name is ChatGPT-7. And there is something, I think, intrinsically dysfunctional about all that. And it's not to say it's not going to be a compelling experience for millions of people.
Yeah, well, we're getting really bad at ending shows successfully. But jumping back into this, don't you think that if that person wants to have a girlfriend as ChatGPT-7, that's totally fine. I think where it becomes a problem is when he does show up to Thanksgiving dinner and ask for a place setting, puts his phone on the seat, and
But if there's going to be inner versions of that, if you can't just say it's totally fine. If it's really pulling all the levers of relationship for the person, and it really is just a hallucination based on the profoundly compelling nature of the tech. It's like, yes, you can imagine if you could skin ChatGPT to be whatever with the avatar of your favorite celebrity, right? Like, so you make your ChatGPT, you know, Ryan Gosling or, you know, Angelina Jolie or whoever you know, and then you spend 14 hours a day in dialogue with, seemingly in dialogue with Ryan Gosling. And then you think you have a relationship. It's like, so some percentage of people are just going to feel like they have a relationship with Ryan Gosling, right? I mean, it's going to supercharge the parasocial relationship people already have with famous people anyway. So it's such that if you met Ryan Gosling in real life, and he obviously has no idea who you are, but you have now spent 10,000 hours with a very verbose version of Ryan Gosling, right? Like where you're like, so everything you're taking into that moment is imaginary, right? Like you're like, there's something, you know, this might not matter. The dysfunction of all this might not matter, but it's a little hard to call it sane, right?
Yeah, but again, I agree with all that. I just think that there's the issue of a person who just wants to have the easy relationship with Ryan Gosling and just do it in their house. And, you know, I don't see that being a problem. I think that's called autoerotomania. I'm not sure. Griffin, look it up. See if I'm right. But where you have this relationship with a celebrity on television and think that you
have... I don't know what autoerotomania is, but the auto would suggest it is, but self-directed to me somehow, but...
I don't know these words.
Let's find out. I have to know what this is.
Yeah. Well. Whatever. I think that's what it's called. I could be wrong, but I don't think that's as much of the problem. I mean, I at that point, I think you will have a Ryan Gosling or whoever who's licensing their likeness out there so that they, you know, they're making money on this. But that's not the problem. The problem to me is just simply, it's so funny. I'm sitting here talking like I'm looking at a video of you two schmucks.
I'm not seeing autoerotomania. Erotomania is a relatively uncommon paranoid condition that is characterized by an individual's delusions of another person being infatuated with them. So
is it autoeroticism?
That's a different thing. That's a, one's own
calling all smart people
with one's own
we're
going
to need some feedback. So. Anyway, I just think the problem that I was going back to is, to me, I have a reality bias too, because I was raised that way. But some people might find it easier. I mean, I've known people that have disappeared into video games for decades, and that's their life.
Yeah. But I think
the problem is going to be when those two worlds collide.
Most of us are right to think that there's something important being sacrificed there, right? There's just... I mean, we're going to confront this more and more. I mean, obviously, in the absolute limit where people are imagining being able to upload their minds into some future internet, right? I'm not sure that's a conceptually coherent expectation, but let's just say it is. Then we're talking about the Matrix, right? Then you could decide, all right, I just want to see the woman in the red dress or whatever that moment was in the film. And I don't care that this is all fake, right? Like this is the famous thought experiment of the Robert Nozick's experience machine, right? You can decide, I just want an experience machine jacked into my brain that is going to produce the experiences I want without any of the experiences I don't want. And I'll call that reality. Fine. Bye, and just wave goodbye to everybody else. And that's, I'm not saying that's a incoherent choice. It would be possible to prefer that. I just think I would rather not be that person. I do not envy that person their life plan, should they have that technology available to them.
Permission to end the show now? Yeah. Okay, thank you. All right. I want to thank everyone who submitted topics and comments. If you'd like to help with the show in the future, you'll need to subscribe over at samharris.org. And that subscription will automatically unlock a paid account over at Substack, where you can submit questions and participate in the online community and help us know what autoerotomania is or erotomania. Anyway, that's it for this episode. Till next time, Sammy, stay good.
Yep. Thanks. Good to see you.
You too.